Welcome to The Vile Preacher, your weekly podcast where we talk about the Bible and make a playlist. I'm Matt Kittle, pastor at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Los Angeles, California.
I'm Zach Paris. I'm the pastor of Lutheran Campus Ministry University, Colorado Boulder. But I'm coming to you live today, Matt, from the Rose City, from Portland, Oregon, USA, where I'm on site for the PLA conference, the Public Library Association conference, where I am a spouse with nothing to do but enjoy my boutique hotel room with my own espresso maker, as you can see here, Matt. I've been enjoying the Nespresso straight into the veins. I'm looking out over beautiful downtown Portland. I can see Powell's from a hotel room, the bookstore. So things are pretty good for me here.
Amazing. What is the most hipster thing you've seen in Portland?
Thing that I've seen. That's a good question, Matt, that I don't have a great answer for.
Because you've been too busy scoping out stadiums.
I made the pilgrimage. Matt, I'm going to write this at some point. I'm going to write a thing. But a couple of weeks ago at Bank of America Stadium in Charlotte, North Carolina, 74,000 people watched the first game of an MLS expansion franchise called Charlotte FC. I grew up, you know, playing some of the soccer, but that didn't exist at the time, right? And so my mom was the middle school soccer coach, even though, you know, she had never played or really had soccer experience in any way. Before then, she had to fight. Like, we practiced in the outfield of a softball field at a church that wasn't near the school. So we had to get on a bus every day to go across town to play on a field that was not a soccer field because the soccer field didn't exist. She had to fight like athletic directors and football coaches and band. Like, her most intense fight was actually with the band director because a compromise at some point was that the team could play games on the band practice field. And that was heresy. So my mind is blown, Matt, that I watched on TV the other night, 74,000 people, a sellout, the single game record for MLS in Charlotte, where the place where, you know, super interesting. I don't know if I talked about it on the podcast before, Matt, but I grew up in a small town in North Carolina that strangely, when I was growing up, became one of the centers of Costa Rican immigration to the United States. So it was until late high school that I understood that most people who spoke Spanish were not from Costa Rica. I assumed they were, right? And so my mom, my family was kind of on board, like, with this emerging community. We didn't have, like, club travel soccer teams nearby. But one time in one of those, like, giant tank Suburbans, my parents took a bunch of us over, like, three towns over to go try out for this team, and we made it. And so three nights a week, my parents hauled all of these folks back and forth to this several towns away and all over North Carolina and the South to go to tournaments and stuff, where we mostly got destroyed because we hadn't played very good people before. And so to go from that, right, like this, like, there's no soccer culture at all, and it's not welcome, to 74,000 people in Panthers Stadium is just wild, Matt. And in one of my formative soccer memories, because another thing, right, is that growing up back then, soccer wasn't on TV. It was on ESPN occasionally, but you had to have cable or something, and cable didn't come to my house. So I would get, my grandfather had one of those giant satellite dishes, like the not direct TV ones, you know, the ones like where you needed to be an astronaut to know how to use it and stuff. And he would record soccer games for me on VHS when they came on TV. So there are about three matches, including an MLS Cup where DC United defeated the Colorado Rapids, that I just watched over and over and over again because it was the only soccer I could watch. The first live soccer event that I ever recall watching on TV was in Portland, Oregon, in 1997, it was a World Cup qualifier between the United States and Costa Rica. So I had my Costa Rican connection. And Tab Ramos just hits this laser from outside the box. puts the biscuit in the basket, the onion in the onion bag. The U.S. wins 1-0 to qualify for the 1998 World Cup. I remember calling my friends on our landline to talk about what had just happened and how cool it was. Tab Ramos also played college soccer at North Carolina State University, so there's your another connection. So I made my pilgrimage, as I do whenever I'm in Portland, go to Providence Park, which is the stadium where the Timbers play, which is the coolest stadium in the United States. It's
why is it cool?
It's so cool. It's just got, it's perfect, right? Like it's super old school in the sense that like they weren't like, we'll build a soccer stadium here. It's built in, it's kind of downtownish, but it's like built around buildings and stuff, right? There's a gym on one side of it that's still there. And so there are people like working out during matches that can like look into the stadium because that's, they can only like, it's constrained in that kind of fun way that like stadiums like your Wrigley's and your Fenway's are. And so it's got this huge, like it used to be a baseball stadium and a huge like U shape at the bottom at one end, which is the supporter section. And it all has overhanging roofs because we're in Portland, obviously, where it rains. And so they do insane TIFO stuff like off the roof where they like drop banners and stuff. It is so cool. It's just so cool. And the outside is cool because they've got like an old school, like, I don't even know what you would call it. It's kind of like a scoreboard. It like announces the upcoming like fixtures, but it's all in like hand letters that they've like put onto the board and stuff. And so cool. So cool. And there is an alliance, Matt, I don't know if you're aware of this, between the supporters of the Chicago Fire Soccer Club, which is my and your club, and the supporters of Portland Timbers. We have something of a kinship. So it's good to see the kinfolk.
There's an alliance between what?
Supporters of the Timbers and the Fire.
What? Why is that?
Mm-hmm. You just find friendly supporters groups, you know, out and about. Timbers define themselves over and against Seattle Sounders, who they call a plastic club. Right. So that's how that like they define each other. Like Portland's like real gritty, like we're real supporters in this like converted stadium and stuff. And they would say Seattle are like have bought all of the like credibility soul that Portland has. Right. So they play in a fancier, shinier stadium. They're richer. They can buy better players. So you're like a plastic, like fake. And plastic, kind of like credit card, like you're a plastic club. And Section 8 likes to think of itself as a not a plastic club, though we don't have rivals to like call plastic. But until recently, we had no rivals in the sense that everybody was better than us. So,
right.
But today, Matt, this is Soccer Central. That's why people come to the podcast. They want to know about the Bible. They want to know about playlist, and they want to know what we think about soccer. Matt, today is a big day. When we record it, because tonight, Matt, at 7:00 Pacific time, which we're both on, which made scheduling very easy, the United States will play in the Azteca, in Estadio Azteca in Mexico City, World Cup qualifier, everything to play for, Matt. I'm going to go watch it tonight, hopefully with the American Outlaws here in town. It's going to be exciting. But here's the kind of fun and sad thing, Matt. This might be the last really important game the U.S. plays in the Azteca, because the 2026 World Cup, which is coming up after this human rights violation that we call the Qatar World Cup, will happen in 2022. It will be hosted in Mexico, the United States, and Canada, and so all three of those teams will automatically qualify for the World Cup. So there won't be qualification in 4 years, so we won't be playing in Azteca then. And then in 2030, the World Cup will be at 48 teams. Which means CONCACAF will probably get about 6 teams in, which means qualification will not be as important or serious as it has been, with 2 to 3 teams qualifying, maybe 4. So this might be the last great Azteca match.
Amazing. Sounds good.
Check it out, dear listener, if you've got a time machine. I can go back to Thursday, March 24th.
I've been there. I've been to Azteca.
I'm so jealous.
I can't remember the exact date, but yeah, it was the Super Clásico.
Ooh.
America and Chivas.
Chivas.
Amazing stuff. Yeah, I was just talking to my kids, trying to get them interested in playing soccer. Because you get to that age, you know, you can get them in the little, little soccer leagues and stuff. We haven't got them signed up yet, but they haven't expressed a lot of interest. They're like, no, I don't really want to do that. So I thought maybe I could get them excited about Angel City FC, and then we could like parlay that into some soccer playing. Which really might getting them excited about jerseys, because obviously, it worked. They're very excited.
Nice.
Do all the things. Oh, that's all it took. That's all it took.
For our listeners who care much more about the aesthetics of sports than the sports themselves, which is where Matt and I mostly are, you should know that teams in the NWSL, the National Women's Soccer League, typically have really cool stuff. For some reason, like in Chicago, the Chicago Red Stars, which is the NWSL team, has super cool kits and stuff. Here in Portland, even, I mean, the Timbers are super cool. All the Timber stuff, super cool. It goes back to old NASL days in the 70s, but their women's team are the Portland Thorns because it's the Rose City, and their stuff is sick. It's so cool.
Thorns is a pretty fantastic name. Pretty.
Ugh, it's perfect.
Pretty great. What's I looked up Charlotte FC. It's got a crown on it.
Mm-hmm.
What's a crown about?
It's the Queen City.
It's the Queen City. Is that it? It's
City? The QC, baby. No matter what the people in Indianapolis or Cincinnati say, everybody tries to be the Queen City. Cincinnati, I think, is the other city that claims being the Queen City. Queen Charlotte.
Gotcha.
Queen Charlotte. I'm going to have to look it up where that comes from, but Queen Charlotte... North Carolina name. Let's see here. Charlotte of Mecklenburg Strelitz, which is the queen consort of George III. Our good friend.
Fantastic. Nice blue jerseys.
Mm-hmm. They've got some sick mint ones too, though, for their aways.
Yeah.
Mint, because it's Charlotte had a mint, and so that's sent milk. There's a place in Charlotte called Mint Hill.
That's why it says Charlotte Football Club minted 2022. Mm-hmm. That's what the logo says, minted.
The mint stuff's cool. Mint stuff's cool.
That's why you come to this podcast, y'all, to get caught up on the latest soccer happenings.
And fashion.
Fashion.
Well, Matt, it's been real.
Wait. It's been real. What a podcast. I'm not in Portland, Zach. I'm not anywhere but Los Angeles. We moved into our new house over the weekend, which means that we can never leave.
You are now an arborist.
We have checked in to the Hotel California, and we can never leave. So that's where we're at. That's where we're at.
So exciting, man.
It's good, though. I did buy a lawnmower, or I should say my father-in-law bought me a lawnmower.
Ooh, what kind of lawnmower did you get? This is the stuff you've been talking about.
I went to New York Times Wire Cutter for best lawnmower.
That's where the best lawn advice comes from, is New York Times.
It's totally it. They had a best lawnmower, a couple rankings. It's an Ego Electric with double blade. What with the double blade? There was a single blade, but I was like, no. I need this grass to be pristine. As someone who hasn't mowed a lawn since college, I need my grass to be pristine. So, I charged it up. Have not used it yet because I just picked it up yesterday from the Lowe's hardware store. And that's where we're at. But it's a big, big life step getting a lawnmower.
It's huge. It's huge. And you're really helping the environment. The worst violators of like emission stuff is small engine things like lawnmowers and weed eaters and leaf blowers and stuff. So it is really important that we move to electric small engine stuff. Last year, maybe it was this past summer, I went electric, man. I got an electric lawnmower and love it. Only issue is turning radius is a little big. It's not as tight as my really dirty gas mower. But I feel better about myself.
Yeah, good. Mm-hmm.
Existential dread. Which, by the way, Matt, I'll talk about this. How about this? This is going to be our segue in. You ready? I've been doing, the Queer Catechism with students where we look at the Luther's Small Catechism through the lens of gender, sexuality, and systems of oppression. And the By Heart book, gosh, I can't remember the title of it, that our friend Guy and some folks helped out with. It's a kind of a commentary on the Small Catechism. Has been what I've been using to help myself prepare. And at some point in the creeds and stuff, they get into the idea that we read it and we hear that the medieval church is just really concerned about, like, had existential dread around, like, going to hell. And that's hard for us to wrap our minds around or to understand. And that Guy or whoever was writing that chapter made the analogy that how they felt and what Luther's trying to, in the catechism, is writing to try to, like, be an antidote to, is the, like, kind of existential dread that we feel kind of around Bo Burnham's sort of that funny feeling that we knowingly participate in all of these systems of oppression that we can't find our way out of, recognizing that we cannot save ourselves, and so that it doesn't matter and there's nothing we can do about it, and that's what people are talking about with that, like, dread of that existential dread that you hear in so much of, or at least in the inverse in what Luther's writing against.
Yeah.
And I found that really helpful, you know?
Yeah.
Illuminating.
Yeah, indeed. And it gives you another excuse to listen to that funny feeling.
It does. Just be sure to listen to the cover. It's really good. With Phoebe Bridgers, who, when folks, we're recording for Sunday, right, Matt? For Sunday, April 3rd, which is Grammy night. And I'm not enthused, Matt. It doesn't look good. I don't care.
It doesn't look good. I'm so behind on the Grammys. Is she nominated?
No.
No. Yeah.
No. Brandy's nominated. Jon Batiste. It's pretty vanilla.
Jon Batiste is good.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, I haven't caught up lately. I was excited to see Batiste on there, but I haven't looked at much. Was trying to keep up with the Oscars, and I think I've seen maybe two of the movies now. Two of them.
I don't know that I've seen any of them.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, have you seen these texts?
I have seen these texts. I perceive them.
There's some fun ones, Matt. This is an exciting day.
Yeah, no, they're good. Year C, just, it's some bangers here. It's good. It's a good Lent.
Finally.
Fifth Sunday in Lent. It's the last one before Holy Week, before Palm Passion Sunday. Fifth Sunday in Lent. We're hitting a crescendo here. First reading is from Isaiah. We're back to Isaiah. Isaiah 43, 16 to 21. It's a good one. A reading from Isaiah. Thus says the Lord, who makes a way in the sea, a path in the mighty waters, who brings out chariot and horse, army and warrior. They lie down, they cannot rise. They are extinguished, quenched like a wick. Do not remember the former things or consider the things of old. I am about to do a new thing. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it? I will make a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. The wild animals will honor me, the jackals and the ostriches, for I give water in the wilderness, rivers in the desert, to give drink to my chosen people, the people whom I formed for myself, so that they might declare my praise. Word of God, word of life.
Thanks be to the God of all jackals and ostriches, flightless birds.
Indeed. Good stuff here. Begins with a callback to the Exodus. Make a way in the sea, path in the mighty waters. Brings out the chariot and the horse. Just incredible Exodus stuff here. Looking back to the Exodus, but maybe for you liturgically looking ahead to that Easter vigil text. Horse and rider, he is thrown into the sea. Such good things. Then we get just this incredible, powerful line. If there was a chorus, if there was something that would get stuck in your head from this text, do not remember the former things or consider the things of old. I am about to do a new thing. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it? When I redid my paperwork a while back, and they asked for the three themes most evident in your preaching and teaching, this was one of the verses I selected. I'm about to do a new thing. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it? I love it. Love it. Love it. Although I want to point out that we began Lent by saying, remember, that you are dust, and to dust you shall return. And here, on the fifth Sunday of Lent, do not remember the former things. There's some interesting playing going on with remembering. And then, call back to the wilderness. I'll make a way in the wilderness, rivers in the desert. And here we get this water imagery. It's almost like the waters are beginning to gather for that baptismal font of the vigil. Good stuff all around. What do you think?
Oh, it's an excellent source of imagery for preaching. Just a couple of Hebrew notes, Matt. Makes a way in the sea. That's way is in Derek. So it might even be a little more provocative than like, it's a road, builds a road in the sea, which is, I mean, you could do a whole sermon on that. The God who builds a road in the sea, right? That sounds a lot like the God who plants a fig tree in a grape vineyard. It is certainly calling back to Exodus, but pretty provocative there. It's a little more provocative than the NRSV gives us. The wild animals were honor me, the jackals. I am super... I always find it super intriguing when you get like a random reading and there's like an animal, right? Because like, just super interested in how the ancient Near Easterners thought about zoology and how they labeled animals and stuff. So number one, I looked up ostriches because I was like, that's a choice. Certainly they knew about ostriches, but is this the only time, I thought to myself, is this the only time ostriches are mentioned in the Bible? And no, Matt, there are, depending on how you translate it, 8 to 11 references to ostriches in the Old Testament. They like ostriches. I found a source that said ostriches were symbolic of mourning and loneliness. So there's something. Interestingly, I don't know what to do with this part. The Hebrew word for ostrich is incredibly similar to the Hebrew word for owl. So there's some discrepancy. That's where your discrepancy comes from, over how many times ostriches are referenced versus owls.
Interesting.
But then, Matt, jackals. Then I was like, oh, jackals. That sounds less interesting. I wonder what's up with that. And I did my word study on that, Matt. And every other instance of this word in Hebrew gets translated as dragons. Right? So... So we get jackals and ostriches, which could be just, you know, background characters in the reading. But if we hear the wild animals are going to honor me, including the dragons, which is, you know, this personification of all human fear, are going to serve this God. And then the ostriches, the symbol for loneliness and mourning, are going to rejoice. We've got some pretty provocative imagery to go with, that fits with like rivers running in. The desert. So I think when you open up jackals to dragons and ostriches lonely with their heads stuck in the sand, I think that opens the door up to a lot of human experience that's pretty preachable in most congregations.
Yeah. Amen. Love it.
Well, Matt, as we have made our New Year's resolution to at least look at letters from our good friend Paul, we have stumbled upon a reading from Philippians, Matt, that is brought to you by the Dave Matthews Band. This is the most Paul of all Pauls. It's what I sometimes find pretty frustrating about Paul. But if anyone has reason to be confident in the flesh, I have more, right? Gosh, he's the worst humble bragger in the world because he's not humble at all about it. He needs to work it on the humble part of his humble brag. I was circumcised on the eighth day, a member of the people of Israel, tribe of Benjamin, Hebrew born of Hebrews, and to the law, a Pharisee, as to zeal, persecutor of the church, as to righteousness, blameless. And then he tries the humble. He's not great at it, but he'll give it a go. Whatever gains I had, I've come to regard those as loss because of Christ. More than that, I regard everything as loss because of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord. For his sake, I've suffered the loss of all things. I lost all of that, and I regard them as rubbish in order that I might gain Christ and be found in him, not having righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but one that comes through faith in Christ. I want to know Christ and the power of resurrection by sharing his sufferings, by becoming like him in his death, if somehow I maintain the resurrection of the dead. And again, humble, still working on the humble. Not that I've already obtained this or have already reached the goal, but I press on to make it my own because Christ has made me his own. Beloved, I do not consider that I've made it on, but I know this one thing, is one thing I do, forgetting what lies ahead and straining toward what lies, or forgetting what lies behind and straining forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the heavenly call of God in Jesus the Christ. Matt, it is typical Paul. And yet, if we're going to ring it out, and I'm going to put my cynicism away, I think there's some stuff in there I really like. I really like the straining towards what lies ahead, that if we're setting up this world, this incredible vision in the Isaiah reading of a world where the dragons and the ostriches, when there are roads running through the water and rivers in the desert, that's not this world, you know, it's not the world I'm living in today. And so this, like, somehow there's some earnestness in the Paul where he struggles with earnest towards just striving towards what lies ahead, pressing on for the goal that we are not yet already at, I think is pretty good and realistic news. Because if the bar is getting dragons to change their ways, I'm not optimistic.
Yeah. Yeah, my initial reaction is I don't like Paul at all. And yet, yeah, like you said, then you get to these lines, forgetting what lies behind and straining forward to what lies ahead. What a connection, call back to Isaiah there. There's some good stuff here. You could listen to Dave Matthews and preach on this. You could make it work.
Oh, just don't listen to it too much.
Good stuff. Gospel according to John.
I got really excited when I saw this, Matt, because I thought, oh, slam dunk, Lazarus. You could always preach the hell out of Lazarus. You know, it's Easter. You get a little Easter before Easter. You can work on your Easter sermon. But it's not the one about Lazarus. It just references him.
Yeah, it's not the one about Lazarus, but it does reference it. And really having some knowledge of that Lazarus story is really helpful. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, the home of Lazarus, who, in case you'd forgotten, he had raised from the dead. There, they gave a dinner for him. It's the least you can do after somebody, like, raises you from the dead. Can we cook you dinner at least, you know? Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those at the table with him. Just a reminder, Lazarus still alive. Mary took a pound of costly perfume made of pure nard, anointed Jesus' feet, and wiped them with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, the one who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. He kept the common person used to steal what was put into it. Just a little pop-up video annotation from John for you there. Jesus said, "Leave her alone. She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." The gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
I mean, there are so many. I mean, it's not the Lazarus story, and yet, like, you got to know that Lazarus was dead and has been raised and now is at the table. Even the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. The stench from that Lazarus story is so vivid, right? And now here there's a fragrance of this perfume. It really is a continuation of that story in so many ways.
Matt, we talk about Lent very often, at least you and I do, because we have a predilection towards this perspective as a journey. And we might like to think, knowing that Easter's around the bend, that the deeper we get into it, like at some point we come around to clarity, right? Like the cross is coming into view. I feel like I've preached before, like starting to come into focus. You might hear that in pulpits these last Sundays of Lent. What I think this story does for me, this year at least, is it's really emphasizing how completely and utterly lost we are, that there's no focus, there's no clear. It is so bizarre on one hand, this incident, right? Like there are a number of things happening here that don't make sense. And like, it sets up as this, like, Judas was wrong, but Mary was right kind of thing. But it's not that. Like, it's this other. So, yes, guests to a home routinely would have their feet washed, typically by a servant or slave, not by, like, the person who owns the house, which Mary does. So she breaks that, like, social norm. You wouldn't wash somebody's feet with perfume, especially not, you know, it's like a year's wage, like worker's wage, the amount of perfume she uses here. She's not, and we might normally say, like, oh, she's anointing his body for burial. But that's not how you anointed someone's body for burial. You had to do the whole body, not just the feet. A woman would never in public touch another man who's period, much less someone who's not her husband. A woman wouldn't allow anyone who's not her husband to see her hair, much less rub her hair all over his feet, right? This doesn't make sense. Like, even with the perspective that she's preparing his body for burial, which is it's certainly a thread here, it doesn't make sense. And it's incredibly confusing. And so I think that's a big part of the text, right? Is to invite us into that, like, no, you think we know, like, you're like next week's Palm Sunday and you know the stories and we know them and we've been through them before. Well, come here first, right? Because we got to get turned, like, we have no idea what's going on or what's happening here. The other thread I set up, man, is if you read a little John 11, there are some things going on that it's important to know. Namely, it goes back to this resurrection of Lazarus, which turns the Judean authorities, understandably, anti-Jesus, and they become resolved that we're going to, like, we got to get this guy arrested and stuff. Because he's going to, like, he's raising people from the dead. The Romans are going to come in and crush us. We got to handle this, right? So they resolve to arrest Jesus. They also resolve to re-kill Lazarus because you can't have Lazarus running around talking about being raised from the dead. So they're going to see if they can do that, do a better job of killing Lazarus this time. And so the folks, they're in Bethany and like moneyed people like Martha and Mary here, they would know that's all coming to happen. And so they would also know that Jesus is most likely headed for crucifixion, which would lack a proper burial. And most times they'd like leave the body up and scavengers and birds of prey would like do their thing. So on one hand, if you want to do the contrast thing, one of the contrasts that's happening here is that Mary is living into the world as it is, full of really harsh realities, and that the other folks gathered there wanting to argue about what we should do with perfume and serving, that sort of stuff, are living into the reality they're living into a world that ignores the really difficult realities that Jesus is headed towards the cross and that he's going to die and he's not going to be able to receive like what is important to them, an important like ritual burial. They're not going to be able to prepare the body. And so they get to like, there's a lot of denial going on the other side. Rather than accepting the difficult realities of the world.
Yeah.
Which can make you do some pretty bizarre things.
Yeah. And so, yeah, thinking through that a little bit and the bizarreness, the image that I have in my head is that there are like cracks in the foundation of reality. There's this tear, there are these tears in the fabric of reality, and there's these new shafts of light that are starting to come through. If you think about, behold, I'm going to do, forget the former things, I'm about to do a new thing. We're like things are shifting. It's no longer stable, right? And so these things, like, they don't make sense because there are these cracks all over the place in the foundation of reality itself. I'm getting all sci-fi on it, but that's like the imagery that I feel in my head. And the authorities, as you're describing, are almost like trying to keep it together. No, we got to re-kill Lazarus because he needs to stay dead. Like, we need to keep this thing together. We need to keep the old reality sewed up and neat. And even Judas here, you could read that as part of that, like, that's a way of thinking about denial. That, like, no, we've got to hold on to the old reality. We've got to keep it together. We've got to keep these seams together. We've got to plug in the dam. And yet, this rupture, this crack in the fabric of reality, this tearing of the curtain is going to happen. It is already happening. It's already happening here. And I think it points us to just how big this this Easter moment is going to be, that it's bigger than we think. So yeah, a lot going on.
It makes me think, Matt, I'm not sure how I would actually tie this into a sermon with this sort of, there is a somberness to this gospel. But it makes me think of like of washing groceries, which is a thing people did at the beginning of the pandemic. You know, yeah. Like some people would bring you'd bring the groceries home or get them ordered, and then you'd like wipe them down or like quarantine your groceries like in a garage and stuff for a while. And so I'm struck by that, like at least like looking back, the bizarreness of that, how bizarre that would be. Like if you saw someone now like doing that. That'd be super bizarre. Not like wrong, but just like what is happening, you know, with the washing of Jesus' feet here.
Yeah. There's also just such an interesting, I mean, what to make of Judas's question. We know what John wants us to make of it. It strikes me though as like, I mean, as a former college philosophy major, it sounds like it's such a theoretical question, right? There's this very real embodied act going on between these two people at this table. And then Judas throws in this like theoretical, but shouldn't we have, but what about this? You know, like, and it doesn't really like, you know, like we're not writing a paper, Judas, like this is not like, and so I don't know, like, I'm not sure how you tie some of those things in, but there is this like, you know, there's theoretical theology and systematic ethics. Then you can think through those things, and that might be helpful to do from time to time. But when you get down to it in day to day life, there's also this like, who is this person in front of you? You know, and how often Jesus was able to navigate that as well, from like his teaching to like, there's a human in front of me, and I'm gonna deal with that human. I'm gonna address that human. I'm gonna give that person my full attention.
And that's kind of, I mean, I think that's an excellent example of what it can look like to press on, you know, just strive forward to lean into the, how does Paul say it here, right? Straining toward what lies ahead, pressing on. I think that's what it looks like. You know, it's not a perfect plan for how to get from this world that's falling apart into the world that God is holding for us, but it is this one step at a time, the person, the people that are in front of you.
Yeah. Amen.
Hey, there's a sermon in there.
What are you listening to?
What am I listening to, Matt? Well, I'm in a little place called Portland, Oregon. So I'm listening to some Portland artists. I was surprised, Matt, when I threw Ostrich into the Spotify search engine there, Matt. A number of songs about ostriches, evidently. Ila Bamba, which is a Portland-based artist, has a song called Ostrich that fits. It's nice. Take it for a spin here. You know, I have an ostrich story. I've probably told it before on the podcast, but at one point when I was a child, my father was called by someone who bought some ostriches and needed to move them and didn't have a trailer. And we had a horse trailer. And so we went on this big, silly adventure to move ostriches. And it turns out ostriches are terrifying because they're essentially velociraptors, except bigger, because they had that big claw, right? Like a velociraptor claw.
Yeah.
And they can kill you because they're very strong. And so you got to trick them and put a sock on their head, because if they can't see, they can't like murder you. So we had to like trick them, put socks on their head, and then like push them into the trailer. It was a whole thing. That said, though, I'm going to go with a couple other Portland-based artists. The Decembrists have a song called "Don't Carry It All," and I can hear that playing as we're moving, we're pressing on, letting some things down. You know, like your pride over being circumcised on the eighth day. You don't have to carry that with you where we are headed, by the Decembrists. So we're putting that on the playlist. And last but not least, One More Hour is a song by Slater Kinney about the breakup of Carrie Brownstein, and the other person is not Carrie Brownstein and Slater Kinney. And so you get some breakup kind of vibes going on here. The thing is falling apart with Jesus here in the Gospel of John. Slater Kinney, while out of Olympia, Washington, spent a lot of formative time here in Portland. So I'm putting One More Hour by Slater Kinney on to the pod.
Good. Good stuff. Well, as we were talking through that gospel, it made me think of another, I think, Portland-based artist, because when we saw them, they were all wearing Portland jerseys. Portugal the Man.
Yeah.
We put on a fantastic live show. I think one of our surprising
It was great.
Coachella 2018. Makes you think of Live in the Moment. They've got a good song called Live in the Moment that to me resonates with this John text. Portugal the Man. Always good stuff. I'll throw on there Hoosier with not Hoosier.
That's an Indiana.
You're a proud Hoosier now. Yeah, you're
proud of Indiana. But Hoosier. Tough results of the tournament.
Hoosier with Mavis Staples. Nina Cried Power. And I don't know. I'm listening to that in conversation with Mary's Action here. And then finally, for some strange reason, I've been on a Steve Winwood kick this week. I don't know where it came from, but that's where I'm at. And one of his, I was like, oh, he did this song too? Oh, yeah, this one. Oh, yeah. I remember this. When you see a chance, take it. When you see a chance, take it, which is what Mary does here. So that's what I got. Steve Winwood, Hoosier, and Portugal, the Man.
I like it.
Well, enjoy Portland. It's been real.
Real 90s? I guess I could have done that kind of a theme.